intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Inyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, creation speaker and software engineer.
Fred, we're in this Creation magazine published by CMI. This is their spring 2013 issue, and it's really good.
Oh, it's awesome. I love the story here, Bob. Aren't dinos supposed to have evolved into birds?
Well, that's what they say. They say it right. Yeah.
Well, evidence shows that some dinos actually ate birds.
I love
this story. They found birds inside of a dinosaur.
This is fun because it sort of gives a little challenge to the evolutionary story because it squeezes the time frame. And we're always pointing out how their time frame keeps getting squeezed when they find fossils of things earlier and earlier and earlier.
Yeah, that's a huge leap to go from a dinosaur to a bird. You know, the birds have hollow bones and the dinosaurs don't. I mean, there's all kinds of things we could talk about.
Well, yeah. They didn't only find one bird in this dinosaur. Now, they've found a bird in a dinosaur stomach previously. Mm-hmm. You know what they say? They say there's evidence that dinosaurs liked eating birds. And the evidence is three birds in a dinosaur stomach. That's pretty good evidence.
That's real good. There's not just one, not two, but three.
Yeah, so dinosaurs are preying on birds.
They're trying to thwart their own evolution.
Yeah, they just don't like that idea. Yeah, and these are not just what evolutionists would have us think of as ancient birds. Of course, the evolution story is not true, but the way they tell the story, the primitive birds would be gliders, mm-hmm. so not powered flight, but gliding. And they wouldn't have beaks, they'd have teeth.
Yeah, and they throw in that word primitive to give the illusion that it's
right.
something more ancient.
Yeah, like they say primitive. Simple life.
Yes.
When there is no such thing as simple biological life. These birds that they found, and the fossils in this case are in exquisite condition. The detail that has been preserved, not only of the outer dinosaur, but then its stomach contents and the detail of the birds that this dinosaur ate is just so fabulous. It's very exciting. And these came from China. In fact, Fred, just like Montana in the U.S., the just rich fossil bed of dinosaurs, they got the same thing going on in China. And these birds that were lunch, they had beaks, so they didn't have teeth. And they were capable of powered flight. This is a fun thing to find.
Yeah, so they found birds.
They found birds.
They found birds.
Right.
You know, the next thing is that we'll find wolves in whale stomachs.
Well,
because the whales are going to try to thwart that, you know,
yeah,
bit of evolution.
Yeah, because the wolf-like creature evolved into
a whale.
First, fish came on land,
out of the water, yeah,
evolved into a cow or something.
Yeah.
Then the cow went surfing, evolved back into an aquatic creature.
Yeah.
And that part happened, they say, in 10 million years. And that time frame is way squeezed compared to what they thought originally. And they keep getting squeezed because the story they're trying to uphold is not true. So reality has a way of interfering with fantasy.
Yeah. And they don't provide a way to really falsify their theory, right? I mean, if you're finding birds in a dinosaur stomach, that's pretty good evidence to me that birds didn't evolve from dinosaurs.
Yeah.
But they'll come up with the excuse, well, you know, maybe the birds, you know, these are the early developing birds and they live together at the same time.
Right. And they'll say that.
With the animals they evolved from.
Yeah, they'll say that. But our point is always they keep saying that 1,000 times over.
Yes.
Where they have the ancestor living after its descendants and all this. And it's just everywhere to be found.
Kind of like the Grand Canyon where layers are not where they're supposed to be.
Yeah.
You know, the wrong ones are on top.
Right. Rock on the top of the Grand Canyon dating
things
older
are always
than
upside down
rock
and backwards
on the bottom.
With evolution.
It seems to be the case. So that is one of the many fabulous articles in Creation Magazine. And that's three birds in a dinosaur stomach. And as with creationists generally, this material is pulled from a peer-reviewed scientific journal. This paper was published in PNAS, and that's the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and it was also published in the popular press.
Well, speaking of things that can fly, what about the butterfly? There's a great story in this Creation magazine on butterflies. We've talked about them before.
Yeah.
You know, we love the wing coloration. We've talked about the iridescence of monarch butterflies.
Yeah.
And you're not really looking at pigment color, right? So
right.
If you were to crunch up a butterfly wing, it'd say be brown.
A blue wing. Let's say a beautiful blue iridescent wing, and you crumbled it in your fingers, would you get blue pigment staining your fingers?
No, you'd get the brown pigment.
Wow.
Because the blue comes from light reflection. Light is like a wave.
Right.
And in the right phase, you can get compounding reflecting light to produce a blue. What's cool about the wing is the crevices are like 200 nanometers apart from each other.
Oh, my.
Exactly half the frequency of blue light. And so blue light compounds itself with this light reflection that's going on, and you can see this iridescent blue color.
Yeah.
It's really cool. So you're not really looking at a pigment blue. You're only seeing blue because how it ricochets off to all these canyons in the butterfly's wings.
And the nanotechnology to accomplish that. Like recently, these bioengineers, nanotechnology guys, they're trying to make these little engines and rotors in nanotechnology. And Fred, when they work on this stuff, they work at about 400 degrees below zero. Well, why are you working at that temperature? Because it's so difficult to engineer and to manufacture the things that are inside of living cells. The machines, by the billions of them, are so hard to manufacture. And God's design, his engineering, he manufactures these things that are way more sophisticated at room temperature or the temperature of a living organism, plant or animal. Yeah, God is quite an engineer. So now this article on butterflies has to do with their wings, but it's a different take on their wings. It is how the butterfly is able to fly, and it is not simple like you'd think. If you thought that you're going to make a little toy butterfly, real light, and maybe take a rubber band and wind it up and have plastic wings.
Have it go back up and down.
Up and down. It's not going to go anywhere because the upstroke and the downstroke will cancel each other out.
That's right. There's an interesting rolling effect on the wings, right? As they flap their wings, it's a technical process. It's so ingenious.
It is.
About how it forms a vacuum and it has valves to keep the reverse effect from canceling out the ability to fly. It's just unbelievable.
Basically, they have to use super slow motion video cameras to watch a butterfly. And it turns out the wings are not static.
Mm-hmm.
They have veins and creases in them. And the butterfly, like there's different ways that butterflies fly. But one way is their wings will come together and they will touch like at the top and gradually go down to the bottom, and they'll pull apart and do the opposite. And they could control the way the wings are behaving from one stroke to the next stroke because they have different ways of generating this lift. As you read through this article and you see the brilliance of the design, for one, if you're humble before God, the thought of a butterfly is enough to bring you to worship, to realize how God is transcendent beyond our ability
comprehend. And just to think all of this incredible, the mechanism for flight for a butterfly, how big is the butterfly brain? I mean, the author of this article mentions that it's no bigger than
Obama's brain.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. No bigger than what?
Than the dot of an eye in his sentence. I mean, because you're talking about a very small, very small computer that does all of this stuff, major calculations.
Yeah.
And this thing can change its stroke that you've been talking about in nanoseconds.
Yeah.
Just amazing how this works.
Yeah. It's so fun. And then the fact that they can go thousands of miles, they do. They migrate thousands of miles.
Oh, that's right.
And to some forest in Mexico, to the same
neighborhood. The same place. Yeah.
The same tree, even.
The same tree.
And then, Fred, you and I did a show on butterflies where it's one of our classics, I think, many years ago. And it's online. You just go to realscienceradio.com and look on the right, and you'll see Butterflies Defeat Atheism or something like that, where we talk about the metamorphosis of a monarch butterfly. And they basically put themselves in not a cocoon, but what is it called? A chrysalis. And they liquefy themselves. This is the caterpillar does this. It hangs under a leaf. Just that whole process is astounding. And then it begins to digest itself. It begins to liquefy itself.
So now, it liquefies itself and then starts to digest itself.
It digests itself and it reassembles itself into a completely different kind of creature. Almost all of its internal organs are digested. So it becomes a liquid.
Because it knew that it was evolving into something.
So just imagine, now evolution has to get you through all the phases of this. Mm-hmm. Before you've got it down, you've got to start, right? So the start is you've got this creature, this caterpillar, and it decides, you know, something tells me I should digest myself. I should liquefy myself.
And this will be an advantage.
Yes, right. So I'm going to go in a little crevice in a rock, and I'm going to start to produce enzymes that is going to digest me.
Yeah.
And it gets liquefied. First time ever. Just trying something new. So then what? So how's it going to come out the other side?
So more magic, hocus pocus, and you get your random mutations, you know, mistakes, a whole bunch more mistakes, and somehow this thing starts turning into this beautiful butterfly with incredible aerodynamics and iridescent wings.
You know, there was a popular book by an atheist written about a decade ago. I think it's called something like A Short History of Nearly Everything. And in the introduction, he's trying to describe, you know, starting with nothing and ending up with human beings in our consciousness, our brains. And twice he used the word miracle, twice. And it's so funny because they're just driven to do that. Like Richard Dawkins says, biology is the study of things that appear to be designed. They use the word miracle. I notice it when atheists do that. And they say it's a miracle. And like Christians, we don't do that. You know, if you see a baby born and just how the wonder and awe of a baby being born, we don't say, oh, that's so homo. I mean, we don't do that. You know, we don't take the enemy's term or concept and say, wow, that must be pure random chance. No, we say that's God. That's God's design. Turns out the other side does it too. They're just in denial.
They're in denial. I mean, one of the researchers they quote here, he talks about how the study of evolution inevitably involves much speculation and inference, and it would be a mistake to imagine that we understand the course of evolution in butterflies. You know, so he says it's just good enough to get by, and you think of the amazing technology that we've done over the last couple centuries to come up with the space shuttle.
Yeah.
You know, it's an amazing vehicle.
Yeah.
But I'd love to compare the size of the computer on the space shuttle with the size of the computer on the butterfly.
Right.
It's not even a comparison.
And even atheist evolutionists have acknowledged that a living organism is more complex than the space shuttle. It's more complex.
Yeah, far more complex.
And it does something the space shuttle could not do. It reproduces itself.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Right?
Yeah.
So, and
the military would love to have a space, you know, a space vehicle or a military vehicle that reproduces itself.
Yeah, wouldn't that be great? And the butterfly, it's not extinct.
Yeah.
The space shuttle's now extinct.
Oh, that's true. Good point.
Right? So God's design is awesome. And Fred, this leading butterfly researcher, you quote it.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we're going through the Creation magazine, the spring 2013 issue. But this is an authority who wrote the book on butterflies. It's called Butterflies. He's from the Natural History Museum in London. And so when we quote evolutionists who say, you know what, we really don't understand how evolution evolved, you know, the deep mystery of how flowering plants evolved. We don't really understand how, just fill in the blank, birds evolved. But so what do the evolutionists do today? Like Jack Horner, the Jurassic Park guy, not only do they say that dinosaurs evolved into birds, they don't say that anymore, really. That's just the old fogey evolutionists.
Mm-hmm.
The new breed of evolutionists, they say birds are dinosaurs. So a chicken is a dinosaur. Yeah. That's what they say. They say it with a straight face. So a chicken is a dinosaur. And they say, we human beings, we are apes. We are apes. They say, what do you mean proof that humans evolved from apes? We are apes. That's the proof. That's what they say.
So when I go to the museum, are they going to have chickens in the dinosaur display?
They should.
They should, if they're going to be consistent.
They really should. So when they say that, you know, dinosaurs evolved into birds, and I think it's Alan Fiducia, who is one of the world's leading experts on bird paleontology. And he said, look, take, if it was him, I think it was one of the famous evolutionary bird experts. He said, look, take it with a grain of salt. When they say that birds evolved from dinosaurs, they think a chicken is a dinosaur.
Yeah.
So take it from whence it comes.
Yeah. And that's, he did say that, and he called it paleo babble. And this is an evolutionist, the lead evolutionist expert on birds at the Smithsonian. He also says that birds did not evolve from dinosaurs.
Right.
Archaeopteryx is a bird.
It's a bird.
Perching bird.
Yeah.
It's not a half dinosaur evolving into a bird.
Yeah. Fred, the next article I think it'd be fun to mention is one on peat bogs. You know, peat bogs, like in, I always think of England, the United Kingdom, when I hear about bogs, because they've got these, just this amazing environment of peat that can build up flat lands, and it's always in a very damp environment. And they could be up to 40 feet deep of solid, waterlogged peat. And it's the decay, the decomposition, the remains of sphagnum mosses and other types of plants. They say that, well, you know, this stuff proves that the Bible's chronology can't be true, because it would take too many thousands of years to build up 40 feet worth of peat bog.
Yeah. So they come up with an estimate on its growth rate. What's interesting, they mentioned this in the article, when you actually have a pretty accurate way of measuring how rapidly it grows.
Yeah.
So for example, they've looked at it when it's growing over an old road. We can actually measure it and be fairly accurate of how quickly the peat bog grows.
Right.
And so using those growth rates,
which are about three times as fast as what the evolutionists
had said. Yeah, so it's three times faster than they had said. And so that would put a peat bog that's 40 feet deep at what, roughly 4,000 years for that to happen.
4,000 years, which means the very evidence they used to say this proves, and they did, this proves the Bible's chronology cannot be true. This simple peat bog here proves.
Yeah.
It turns out, no, it doesn't. And this information comes from, again, the guy who wrote the book, you know. Well, this actually is an expert on peat bogs. And
he's an expert on peat bogs?
Yeah.
Is that the guy who was caught for illegal gambling on evolution? He's banned from the Evolution Hall of Fame. Pete Boggs.
Yeah. Oh, you're talking about Pete Rose.
Oh, that was Pete Rose. Oh, yeah. Okay.
That was a different sport. That was a different entertainment field. So we have this guy. He published a book through John Wiley and Sons out of New York titled Coal, Its Properties, Analysis, Classification, Geology, Extraction, Uses, and Distribution. The whole book is available online. And he deals with peat bogs because peat bogs, you know, there's a relationship to coal. And there are people who use them as they cut solid blocks out of them and they'll burn them in their stoves as a source of heat. People also bury things in them like butter. And butter has been known to survive for decades.
Yeah. So you're finding butter in peat bogs. What else did they find? They found a human. Pretty well preserved human in the peat bogs.
Yeah, because when things happen to fall in them, they could be preserved.
Yeah, they could. And he was very well preserved, that you could even see his baseball mitt.
So that's their story on peat bogs. And again, what it does is it removes barriers. People have been given misinformation, and that misinformation has been used to undermine their trust in God's word.
Yeah, everything they can get their hands on, and in this case, peat bogs, they've got to sit there and figure out a way.
Everything.
Where can we make this thing
everything
contradict the Bible chronology? And it backfires on them again. When we can actually measure the rate accurately, it matches 4,000 years, which would be about the time since many ice ages that would have occurred after the flood that would have really promoted a peat bog.
Yeah, and so you have an old road, an ancient road. You know, history in England goes back thousands of years. You have a road that's no longer in use. It's discontinued for whatever reason. And people go there 40 years later and they measure the bog that's grown over, you know, part of the curve in the road. And so that's hard data as compared to the theory. And that's fun to see that hard science constantly falsifies the claims used against God's word.
Yeah, and unfortunately, the technical journal where I'm sure this was published, they didn't publish a correction to the story when they come up with these ideas.
Right.
Not very often.
Right. The corrections typically don't come.
They typically don't. I mean, some of them take literally hundreds of years if you think about that recapitulation nonsense.
Yeah, right. And in fact, the junk DNA, Fred.
Oh, that's right.
Funny story. This just out in one of the peer-reviewed journals. It's too new. It's not even in this magazine. But you know how we've talked about this often. Eugenie Scott, Richard Dawkins, all the evolutionists, they use junk DNA. They say because this DNA has no function, most of our DNA is junk. Therefore, we know that there's no designer God.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out that there are thousands of researchers all over the world publishing in peer-reviewed journals saying the junk is not junk. There is function for the vast majority of it that we're finding, and eventually we might find it's about 100% functional, the human genome.
Yep.
So that's fun. You know, that's great. It's sort of like the head of the Human Genome Project, Francis Collins, who is an atheist, a renowned atheist, becomes a Christian. Because if you're honest when you look at the creation, you know that there's a creator. So these researchers are looking at the junk DNA. And Fred, do you remember the trial in federal court in Pennsylvania? There was a school district trying to introduce intelligent design, and it was the Dover trial.
Yeah, the Dover trial. Right. Yeah.
And this judge, he was appointed by George W. Bush, mm-hmm. and his ruling was this vitriol, this hatred against anyone who would dare question the godless evolutionary worldview. But at any rate, the leading evolutionary expert who testified, he used junk DNA. And he said, in fact, he named a pseudogene. They said a junk gene.
Yep.
And it was the beta globin. And he said, this beta globin, we have it in apes and humans and whatever, baboons, and it's broken. It's junk. It can't function. And he said, it's broke in these six different ways. And it's impossible for the same thing to break the same way in these different species.
Yeah. So it's the shared mistakes argument that I've heard before on pseudogenes.
Yes.
And one of the big assumptions they're making among many is that it's a functionless gene.
Right.
If that gene has function,
then that argument,
the argument totally goes away.
Right.
They can't use that argument.
Right. So not only are they using the whole junk DNA, which is gradually being falsified, even when they pick a specific thing that they think is the perfect example, now the latest peer-reviewed journal in molecular genetics says, well, turns out the beta globin seems to be a regulatory gene. There's overwhelming evidence that it is just like other related regulatory genes. And you know what, guys? We think this has an important function.
It's a popular argument by evolutionists. It's out on Talk Origins. I wonder if they'll take down their article that talks about it, because we've said all along that you're assuming that this has no function. And even when I saw this argument 10 years ago, that particular gene they were talking about had sections what are called conserved. In other words, you can't change them.
Right.
Well, that tells you something.
It tells you
it's
not junk.
If you can't mutate something that's, you know, that's supposed to be just a pile of goo, it's worthless, and you can't mutate it somewhere, it's conserved. That tells you that the reason why you can't mutate it, because it has function. If you mutate it in a critical section, that organism's going to die.
Right.
And so you're not going to see that mutation.
Right.
It's going to look conserved, and it's because it has a function.
So if it really was junk, and if evolution really were true, you'd find all kinds of mutation changes among these different species.
That's right.
But it's conserved, telling you that it has function. The evolutionists should understand that. They should have never proposed the argument, but their hatred of God blinds them to the simplest reasoning.
And they distort what natural selection is. Natural selection is something that creationists came up with, and this is natural selection at work. If a mutation happens and it's a harmful mutation, that you don't see it because that organism doesn't survive.
Mm.
It prunes the harmful mutations out of the population.
Fireflies.
Fireflies. Hmm. Those things are cool. We used to go to Missouri and they'd have, boy, you know, misery is what I call it, but the fireflies were cool. I didn't like the humidity and all those other bugs.
Yeah, but you liked the fireflies.
I grew up
in New Jersey, northern New Jersey.
My condolences.
good point. We had a pool in our backyard, and in the summer, we'd have our cousins over, barbecues. We'd have 30 people over in our backyard. And at night, it gets dark. We had a blue spruce. We had an apple tree. By the trees, near the bushes, these fireflies would come out, and all the cousins would start chasing the fireflies. chasing them, putting them in jars. Now your jar's like a flashlight.
Yeah.
And it's so fun. And so Jonathan Sarfati, Dr. Sarfati, who's a physicist, he wrote an article about fireflies and how they work. And Fred, I didn't know this stuff as a kid. I just knew they were cool.
Yeah.
But when they lit up, it was so attractive to especially children. But it was just so intense, the light and the color. And it turns out, here's why. There are three layers. There is the photogenic layer in the middle. And then there's another layer above it called the cuticle. It's the window. And then there's the back layer, which is a mirror, the dorsal layer. And the mirror is extremely reflective. So you have the photogenic layer producing this chemical fluorescent light. And not only is it shining out, but the photons that are going the wrong way hit the reflective mirror, and it all comes out like it's a bright beacon.
Yeah, compounding the brightness. It turns out that these are the best dimensions that you could have to transmit the most light at a peak frequency of 560 nanometers. It's just,
again, we're talking about nanometers.
Marvel,
right?
Of engineering.
Yes. And now scientists, engineers are beginning, they call it biomimetics. They are trying to mimic the design of the firefly.
So once again, you're looking at the creators, that, you know, the most superior engineer of all time, the supreme engineer.
Yeah.
And they're trying to mimic him. And they were able to improve their...
An LED
by 3%. Now, that's a lot in the grand scheme of things.
Because they've been working to refine LEDs for many years. And to take a state-of-the-art LED and then have it produce 3% more light, I mean, you're talking about savings in emissions and money and all that. Oh, and the wavelength of light that it produces, this yellow-green light, incidentally, is the color that our eyes are the most sensitive to, which is one of the reasons why children especially are so attracted.
Yeah.
God designed fireflies partly so that children could enjoy his creation.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's fun. God is fun. You know, the people who say they're in awe of nature, like the atheist, what a shame that they don't know the God who created the nature that they worship.
Yeah, these wonderful things he created to be remembered.
Yeah, and we are out of time, but it's either they worship the creator or the creation, and what a shame when they reject their creator,
God. The ultimate designer.
Jesus Christ. Thank you, Fred Williams. Another episode of Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyar. Our website is realscienceradio.com. Check out the store. Buy one of the science resources. It'll help us stay on the air. May God bless you.
Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.